this is going to be like a kind of introduction, really, to chapters 10 and 11. So I want to read, chapter 10 and then chapter 11 down to verse 26. Now, this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabtah, Rama, and Sabtekah. And the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Aren't you glad I'm reading this tonight and not you? Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ur, Calah, and Rezem between Nineveh and Calah. That is the principal city. Mizraim begot Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Nephtuhim, Pathrusim, and Calsluhim, from whom came the Philistines and the Kaphtarim. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite, the Arvadite, the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. And the order of the Canaanites was from Sidon as you go towards Gera, as far as Gaza. Then as you go towards Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, as far as Lakshah. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands and in their nations. And children were born also to Shem, the father of the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lod, Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arphaxad begot Salah, and Salah begot Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan begot El-Modad, Sheleph, Hazar-Maveth, Jera, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Ibimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. And their dwelling place was from Mesha, as you go towards Sepha, the mountain of the east. These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. These were the families of the sons of Noah, according to their generations, in their nations. And from these nations were divided on earth, after the nations were divided on earth after the flood. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. This is the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. After he begot Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and begot sons and daughters. Arphaxad lived 35 years and begot Salah. After he begot Salah, Arphaxad lived 403 years and begot sons and daughters. Salah lived 30 years and begot Eber. After he begot Eber, Salah lived 403 years and begot sons and daughters. Eber lived 34 years and begot Peleg. After he begot Peleg, Eber lived 430 years and begot sons and daughters. Peleg lived 30 years and begot Reu. After he begot Reu, Peleg lived 209 years and begot sons and daughters. Reu lived 32 years and begot Serug. After he begot Serug, Reu lived 207 years and begot sons and daughters. Serug lived 30 years and begot Nahor. After he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years and begot sons and daughters. Nahor lived 29 years and begot Terah. After he begot Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and begot sons and daughters. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Aren't you glad I read that?
Yes.
Okay, so, interesting passage. Yeah. So, just thinking back then, so we're going back, I guess, a few weeks, maybe a few months now, we've been through the creation narratives in chapters 1 and 2, and then we came into chapter 3, where we read about the fall, and what resulted from the fall, with the judgment of God on Adam, on Eve, and on the serpent. And then in the following chapters, chapter 4 and chapter 5, we started to read there of the escalating consequences of the entrance of sin into humankind as it spread its corruption through the generations that followed that increasingly ungodly period of time before the flood. So we read about that, and we learned from some of the individuals that lived at that time this escalating situation of lawlessness and wickedness within the earth. And then we came to chapter 6, and we read there about this man Noah, and how God called Noah and commissioned him to build an ark, because he told Noah what he was about to do, how he was going to bring the flood to destroy all flesh from the face of the earth. But Noah built this ark at the Lord's command, and so when the time came, he and his three sons and their wives and Noah's wife entered the ark with all those animals, and then God sent the flood upon the earth. And all that had life in its nostrils was destroyed from the face of the earth. And so we read about the events of the flood there. And then towards the end of chapter 9, we read about some of the events that occurred when Noah and his family emerged from the ark into what was effectively a new world in so many ways. The same world, but everything was different. Everything had changed. The landscape had changed, the topography had changed, the climate had changed. You'll notice in the passage that we've just read how the lifespans start to get smaller and smaller as you go towards the end of that passage. Noah's living 950 years, so his son Shem lives for 600 years, and then his son Arphaxad lives 400 years, and then as you go on it gets down to 200 years. When you come into Abram's life, Abram lives for I think 170 years or something like that. And so gradually the lifespans are getting shorter. So all sorts of changes had occurred to the earth. So if you think then about those first 9 chapters, I don't know how you view them, but for me, the kind of action-packed, I mean, it's all going on there, isn't it? I mean, the whole story, and I mean history, I don't mean fairy tale, the whole story is like a fast-moving epic, and there's all these things going on continually, and it's full of interest. I think it is, anyway. I mean, so, some people might think, you know, that sort of last part of chapter 4 and first part of chapter 5 is not up to much for a lot of people because it's a genealogy. But I hope that when we started to look at that, we saw there's more to more to the names than initially meets the eye, because the names tell us something about the people and the lifestyle. So the first 9 chapters, I think, are packed full of interest and excitement. Okay, so that's where we've been so far. But now we come to chapters 10 and 11. And my guess is that this is the point where maybe some people who start to read the Bible, they're all right till now, and then they start to read chapter 10 and they think, nah, I'm going to move swiftly on. And so for a lot of people, they move swiftly on to maybe the end of chapter 11 and into chapter 12, where the story of Abraham kicks off. And then from there on in, you've got Abraham's life, which again is packed, full of epic story of Abraham's life and his walk with God, and then his son Isaac and Jacob and all the rest of it, and so it carries on through the rest of Genesis. So I'm thinking there are some people who leave this passage out, because apart from chapter 11 verses 1 to 9, where you've got the story there of the Tower of Babel, and a little bit in chapter 10 verses 8 to 12 that gives you some details about the life of this man Nimrod, right, apart from that, most of it is genealogies. It's long list of names that are difficult to pronounce, and so yeah, so it's genealogy, it's lists of names of who begot who. And for that reason, I'm guessing some people just skip over these chapters and go straight maybe to verse 27 of chapter 11. But I think, you see, I think that's a mistake. I really do. I don't think there's any part of the Bible that God just slipped in there that's just for the curious, or to, you know, fill a bit of space, like, before he gets to the next bit. All of it is vital information. So it's a mistake to leave it out. So chapters 10 and 11 are here for a reason. So in these studies, we are not going to be leaving chapters 10 and 11 out, even if there are a lot of names in it. We're not going to be leaving these out. We're going to be studying these for the next few weeks. And then when we get to the end of this bit, that is verse 26 of chapter 11, what I'm planning to do is take a little break from this particular Bible study in Genesis. Although we're not entirely leaving Genesis, what I'm planning to do is bring this series of DVD teaching by Ken Ham on foundations. And basically what we've got here is 12 DVDs that last about 30 minutes. And so each session, if we do this, each session will be hearing the Bible study, and then it will be a time for discussion and application. So what these are really about is the chapters that we've just been looking at, chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis, and showing how these chapters are absolutely vital, they're foundational to the Christian life, and are of vital importance to us for all sorts of reasons, especially in this day. Now, if we get to the end of the fourth lesson and everybody comes to me and says, I don't like it, Ian, I'd rather just go back to what we did before, then maybe we'll do that. But I just think that these are good. And what these will do, they'll tie together everything that we've been looking at and put it into and apply it, okay, to our context in a what I think is a good way anyway. And what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and encourage others from the fellowship to come and be part of this. And the younger ones in the fellowship too, because it's especially vital for them. Yeah. It really is especially vital for the younger ones, but it's vital for all of us. And some of the questions that society is thinking about today, and some of the things that are being pushed on society today, are actually dealt with in the context of this. Even questions like, why is the church on the decline, dealt with in these things. So these are very, very good and worth listening to. And as I say, we're not just going to listen to some bloke talking on a screen. There's going to be discussion too. There's going to be interaction, I hope, on the subject. So then when we've done that, what we'll do then is we'll come back to these studies and we'll pick the story up at verse 27 of chapter 11, where the next part of Genesis really begins, and that is the story of Abraham. So that's what we'll be coming back to. Okay, so that's the plan for the future. It'll probably take me to maybe the middle or end of February anyway to get to the end of to get to the part where we start this. Okay, so that
sure
gives us.
Yeah, we're on our
holiday this
year.
Make sure
it does. Oh, okay, yeah. So it will though, because it's not that long away actually. So and there's some important parts of this. So it'll probably be towards the end of February when we start that, and that'll give us time to advertise it as well and put some posters up and maybe encourage folks to come along to that. Okay, so I said that for me anyway. Some people might think I'm a geek, but As far as I'm concerned, chapter 10 and 11 are extremely important, and they're here for a reason, several reasons in fact. Certainly, these chapters answer some of the questions that I think arise in the minds of the inquisitive out of the story of the flood, if we believe that's true, and I trust that we do. Certain questions can arise out of that. For example, if it's true what it says in chapter 9 and verses 18 and 19, it says, the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. So, in other words, what that's saying is, all the people of the world today, you know, all the different groups of people, the different nationalities, the different ethnic groupings, you know, wherever they are in the world, are all descended from these three men, the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham and Japheth. So if that's true, and obviously I believe it is, then question somebody might ask is, so if that is so, then how come, like, you know, all over the world there are people and they look so different? You know, they have different features, different physical features, or different skin colours, or, you know, some groups of people are very, very tall, and then there are some people who are pygmy, you know, whatever. How can that be so, if they all come from the same family, effectively? How is that possible? Okay, well, these chapters actually answer that, when understood correctly. Some people might say on that, surely, when you look at the different features of different human beings from different parts of the world, surely the evolutionary model presented by Charles Darwin explains it far better, some people would suggest. In fact, I mean, this is generally what is believed these days. Well, the fact is that when we understand chapters 10 and 11, we've got a far more logical and reasonable answer for why people have different physical features and different skin colours and different variations of size and shape in different parts of the world. We have a far more reasonable and logical explanation for that in these chapters than Charles Darwin ever came up with. As a matter of fact, it always strikes me as strange that the people who, rightly so, condemn people for racist speech and hateful racist actions, right, condemn that, and rightly so, and yet some of them are ardent Darwinists. And when you actually understand what Darwin said, it is about as racist as it's possible to be. You know, and that to me is bizarre, that the very people who condemn racism, rightly so, actually support a view held by someone that is completely racist by any standards. What the Bible teaches is a far better, far more reasonable, logical explanation. And what the Bible obviously teaches is that even, as I think I said this last time, even the whole idea of racism is utter stupidity and foolishness. Yep. It comes from this false idea of the races. Because there aren't any races, there is one race. Amen. There is one human race. And as it says in Acts 17, He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings. From one blood. Actually, one of these DVDs deals with that very, very subject, actually. So then, there aren't races. There aren't, you know, Negro races and Mongoloid races and Caucasian races. There's one human race. and a variety of different features and different skin colours, but one blood. Okay, and the better explanation as to how that came about is in the very chapters that we're looking at here. And then, of course, there's the subject of languages. Why are there so many different languages in the world? You know, why is it that you know, go to these different people groups in different parts of the world, they speak different languages? If we all came from the same family, who presumably all spoke the same language, why are there so many different languages now? You see, again, if you look at that matter from the perspective of social evolution, you would expect it to be the opposite of what you find, wouldn't you? Think about it. If, from the point of view of social evolution, would it not be better if everybody spoke the same language? Of course it would. And yet what we find is, people speak all sorts of different languages. So if we came from one family, and the geneticists today are agreed that we did, even though they don't agree with, you know, necessarily how the Bible says that, but they're saying that the human race came out of Africa somewhere about 70,000 years ago, whatever the latest thing is. So we all came from the same place. Why are we all speaking different languages? Because if evolution is a steady slope to betterment, then it would be better for the human race if everybody spoke the same language, wouldn't it? But they all communicate. But what the Bible says is we all came from one family, and yet we all speak different languages. Why is that? Well, the answer is found in chapters 10 and 11 of Genesis. So, my plan then with this is, over the next few weeks, is first of all to, I want to set these events within a kind of time scale that I think I might have said in the last Bible study, that I think sometimes we when we read through the Bible, there's a sort of disconnection. We disconnect, you know, Abraham from the people before, and we don't see sometimes necessarily the overlap and who falls within who else's lifespan. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we understand the time element involved here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight, and then we're going to then maybe next week think about this man Nimrod and the empire that he builds, the kingdom that he builds, because Nimrod is a person who builds the first proper human empire or kingdom following the flood. And Nimrod is a kind of archetypal antichrist figure who is extremely interesting. If you're interested in prophecy and the last days, what happened in the time of Nimrod is extremely interesting, because it's all coming round again. So Nimrod, we're going to think a little bit about Nimrod, who's a kind of antichrist figure who seeks to build this one world empire in his particular day. And then we're going to be looking at chapter 11, verses 1 to 9, and concerning the building of the Tower of Babel and what happens there. And along with that, we're going to consider something of the connection between the aims and purposes Nimrod had in building the Tower of Babel then with what is actually happening today. Because the tower is being rebuilt, as I'm sure some of us understand, and for the exact same reasons that Nimrod wanted to build it then, it is being rebuilt in our generation, and the purpose is the same: globalism, one world government that will be ruled over by one man, the Nimrod of the end times, the Antichrist. So there's a prophetic connection between what happened then and what is happening in our world most definitely today. And then following that, because of course God comes down and he disrupts, they were all speaking one language, and God confuses all the languages. So the result of that is that people all gravitate to others that are speaking their language, and so in the different people groups they all then separate and are spread, scattered throughout the whole earth, as it puts it there in verse 4 of chapter 11. So we'll look at that. And so in chapter 10, we then see where these different people groups went. where they went and what the nations were that came from them. And quite interestingly, some of the nations that are mentioned in chapter 10 are also mentioned in biblical prophecy as having a role to play in the end time scenario. So again, it prophetically, it has great relevance to the present day. I was quite interested to see in the news just recently about what is happening in the Middle East, and I've just been reading a book, as it happens, a prophecy book about Iran in the end times, and it's talking all about the Gog and Magog war and the nations that are involved. See, and you've got Russia, and then you've got all these other nations that are Islamic nations. So you've got Turkey in there, you've got probably some of the countries that used to be part of the former Soviet Union, the southern end, which is like Kazakhstan and people like that, those kind of groups. And then you've got Iran and Syria, and then you've got Libya is mentioned in there as well. And of course, it's interesting to see how Russia and Iran are allies now. So this recent thing over the weekend the Americans basically attacked some groups in Iraq that were backed by Iran, caused great... But Russia came to the defence of really standing with Iran because it's their ally. Now I see Turkey getting involved with Libya. And of course, Turkey and Libya are also part of the Gog and Magog alliance, you see. So what you can see is all those nations are lining up. And some of those nations are first mentioned here in chapter 10, you see. So it's extremely relevant, prophetically, a lot of this as well. So we're going to be seeing who some of these nations are and what became of them. Okay, so then for the remainder of this Bible study, what I want to try and do then is set some of these events in a kind of time frame. And the events I'm talking about really are Nimrod and the establishment of his kingdom, which resulted in the building of the Tower of Babel. I want us to think about when that occurred, the Tower of Babel incident, where God confused the languages, and particularly in relation to the lifespan of various other people that are mentioned here. And I think I mentioned this partly in the last Bible study, particularly regarding Shem. But I'm doing this evening for a specific purpose that I will refer to at the end of this Bible study in terms of its relevance and application. So, first of all then, the flood of Noah, according to the biblical dating, occurred in the year 2348 BC. Okay, according to biblical dating, that's when the flood occurred. And at that point in time, it tells us in chapter 7 verse 6 that Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters were on the earth. And he died, Noah, aged 950, which would have been in the year 1998 BC. That is about 2 years, according to biblical dating, it's about 2 years or round about the same time that Abraham was born. About 2 years before, or approximately the same time that Abraham was born, Noah died. Okay, so Abraham's born, possibly. If you look at different scholars, they'll give a slightly different dating, but it's only within a few years. Abraham is born around about the time that Noah died, or a little bit after. Okay, and he dies, Noah, in 1998. And that is around, that is 350 years after the flood. So Noah is living for 350 years after the flood, according to what it tells us here. So then Noah's son Shem, he was born 98 years before the flood. Sounds a bit specific, that. How do I know? Well, it tells us in chapter 11, verse 10, this is the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. Right? So he was 100 2 years after the flood when his son Arphaxad was born, which means he must have been 98 when the flood came on the earth. Isn't the Bible specific?
Yeah.
Huh? Isn't it a remarkable book, this? Some people think it's too kind of general, but it isn't. It is absolutely specific. So he's 98 when the flood comes. He has a son aged 100, 2 years after the flood. And then it tells us that Shem lived another 500 years after the birth of Arphaxad, making him 600 when he died in the year 1846 BC. And so Shem, as I pointed out last time, was around during the lifetimes of Abraham and Isaac. In fact, if the book of Jasher is to be believed, Noah actually went to live in Shem's house for a time when he was a younger man, and then later on, I think it was after the death of Sarah, according to the book of Jasher, he sent Isaac to study with Shem. And what I said in the last Bible study was, even if you want to kick the book of Jasher out because it's a non-canonical document, even if you want to get rid of that, the fact is this, that given that Shem lived in the area not far away from Terah and where Nahor and Terah lived, where Isaac was got his wife from, where Abraham came from, the fact that Shem was there up in that region and was alive at the time of Abraham, called by God, ask yourself a question. If you was Abraham, would you not want to go and visit Shem? I think you would. I would. I would want to go and talk with a man who lived the other side of the flood to tell me what it was all about. And interestingly, you see, Shem, remember Methuselah? Methuselah was still alive until the year of the flood. So for 98 years of Shem's life, he could talk with Methuselah. And do you know who was alive when Methuselah was a young man? Adam. So the information Shem's getting goes right back to the start. Even if you take Noah out of the equation, which you don't need to, because he's there as well. And the point I'm making is that these guys are around, even when Abraham, well certainly Shem is. So he's living for 500 years after the flood. During the time of Abraham and Isaac, and we're not told when Noah's other sons, Japheth and Ham, were born, and we're not told, well, obviously they were born before the flood, because they went on the ark, so it's reasonable to assume that they were a few years old before the flood occurred. So we're not told when they were born, and neither are we told how long they lived after the flood or when they died. And it's not because God doesn't like them. And, you know, it's just because what the Bible does in Genesis is it focuses in on the line of Shem, for obvious reasons, because this is the messianic line. So the focus is really on the line of Shem. So it doesn't tell us when they died. But if we assume that Japheth and Ham, along with their wives, lived for about the same length of time as Shem did, then they were also around somewhere during that period. Okay? Right. So why is all that important? Because now we come to this man Nimrod and the building of his kingdom, which some people estimate the birth of Nimrod somewhere around 2098 BC, and that, I'm not sure where this information comes from, probably from some ancient traditions, but that he was about 40 when he began to reign as a king, and so that is just 250 years after the flood. Nimrod is establishing his kingdom, and it's an apostate, antichrist, one world government empire that exists in rebellion against God's command, which was to be fruitful and multiply and spread throughout all the earth. He wants to keep it all together under his control. And this is but 250 years after the flood. Estimates for the time of the Tower of Babel incident is around 2011 BC or thereabouts. I don't think you can be too precise about that, but round about 2011 is the year that's given in one book that I've got. And so that is just 337 years after the flood, you see, if that date is correct, when the Tower of Babel incident occurred with the dividing up of the languages, etc. 330 odd years after the flood. Noah is still alive at that point, because he lives for 350 years after the flood. Shem is still alive, because he lives for 500 years after the flood. And possibly Japheth and Ham and all the, and their wives were all still alive. Okay. And these people all had lived in the era before the flood, so they knew what had happened. They knew what it was all about. They were involved in the whole project and everything else. And they knew about all of that. They knew God. They knew the true God. And the point is, they were alive and they were available for people to go and talk to and ask concerning the truth. Are you with me? This is the point. And the reason I'm saying this is because, like, you read the Bible and you think, oh, I've done with the story of Noah now. He's finished. Shem, he's finished. Now we're on to Abraham. Mm-hmm. And there's a disconnect. But what I'm saying is, they're still there. And though they're not mentioned in the Tower of Babel incident, they are there. Somewhere around that region, they are there. See, you've got to remember too that the peoples lived in, they hadn't really got much further than that whole surrounding area that's mentioned. Assyria, Elam, that kind of area all around there. So they were there when God mixed up the languages. And my point, you see, is this. Babel, or Babylon, is called in the Bible the mother of every false religion. In Revelation, it's called the mother of harlots. The mother of every false religion is Babylon. In other words, that's where it all started. So if you want to think about something like Hinduism, which, you know, some anthropologists will say is the most ancient religion in the world. It isn't. The most ancient religion in the world is worship of Yahweh, the Creator God. That is the most ancient religion in the world. But Hinduism, and what it's based on, the whole idea and philosophy of Hinduism, where does all that start? It starts at Babel. It starts at Babylon. If you think about Wicca, witchcraft, where does all that start? It starts at Babel. If you think about the Eastern mystic religions of, you know, the force, yin and yang, you know, and all the rest of it, where does all that start? Babel. You think about all the false gods that are worshipped. Where does all that have its origins? Babel. Babylon, you see. That's where it all begins. And we're going to be looking at this in a week or two. That's where it all started. So the Tower of Babel was kind of, if you can think of it as a kind of focal point for the people. What it was summed up the aims and aspirations of that kingdom. It was a rallying point. It summed up the aims and the aspirations which were to bring everybody together. Okay? It was a means of uniting the people together, and it was a visible kind of emblem of their beliefs and their philosophies and their religion, really. And it's all based, you see, around a false religious system and a man-made philosophy ruled over by one man as its head, who's head of the political side of it. And according to tradition, it has a religion that is headed up by his wife, a woman called Semiramis I, who was the head and high priestess of the false religion of Babel. Okay, so they rule over the world by this system. And it appears that the vast majority of people come under its spell and are okay with it. Because you'll notice in chapter 11, it says, then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and build a tower. So it's not just Nimrod whipping them all into submission. They are up for this. They have bought into the idea. They think it's a good idea, and the people are behind it. Right? That is the point. You look at the world today, globalism. That is the aim. Yeah. And are the people behind it? Yes, they are. Big style. And what they've done, the globalists, they have used various things to get people behind it, but the people are willingly behind it. I heard an interesting article on the radio on the news yesterday morning, and they were talking about the fact that turns out this year is the 75th anniversary of the UN, the founding of the United Nations. And what they were saying is that the powers that be within the United Nations are reflecting on where the United Nations are right now and where they need to be heading in the future. You know what and the point that was seemed to be being made is the United Nations has not really met up to expectations. Really, it's achieved certain things, but it seems lame. It seems unable to get past certain things and make a difference in the world as far as peace is concerned and things like that. So they are looking at how to take it forward and make it more effective. I think I know from reading the Bible which way it will go in the end. And I think I know that some point in the future they'll put a fella in there, right, who will rule over it. And he will make it work. And it won't be Jesus. But it will be a Nimrod-like figure. It'll be an Antichrist. He'll make it work for a very short period of time. But it, well, that's the way it's going. And I just find it interesting that it's this point in time when all these other nations are coming together, the United Nations is kind of scratching its head and saying, where do we go from here, boys? You know, we're, how can we become more effective? Isn't the scene being set or something? I think it most certainly is. And so all these things are happening. The Tower of Babel, the Nimrod's empire and all the rest of it. And it's all within 350 years of the flood. Remarkable. And Noah's still there. And his sons are still there. But it looks to me like nobody's asking them what they think. The world are behind Nimrod, right? So it's just 350 years. And that is about the same amount of time from the latter years of John Wesley's life to now. We're talking the same span of time. He died in about 1780s, 90s, something like that, did John Wesley. So from the latter years of John Wesley's life to now is about the same time span from the flood to the Tower of Babel incident. Okay, so that's to put it into a sort of perspective that we can understand. Isn't it amazing how soon things change? How quickly things can turn bad. When they came out of that ark, they knew there was a God in heaven who actually brought judgment on the earth and saved them. And then Arphaxad's born 2 years later and the others start to have children. But within a short space of time, Nimrod is Noah's great-grandson. That's all. His son's grandson. Within a short space of time, they're completely apostatized. How quickly things can change. And how quickly things can change within a church, within a fellowship, within a denomination. And I don't know what you think, but some of the denominations that you can see represented around us today by different church buildings and different streams within the Christian church, you know, are testimonies of two things, many of them. The first is that most of those churches were born out of the fires of revival at some point. Whether you're talking about the Calvinistic Reformed churches, they were born out of the fires of the Reformation, some of those churches, the Lutheran churches, and churches like that. And then you've got other Protestants, the Baptist movements, and different churches, the Methodist movements, the Pentecostal movements, and all these different movements. And the church buildings are all over. And in the first, it's a testimony to the fact that at some point in the past, God moved marvellously to the saving of souls and to the increase in revelation, knowledge of the scriptures through some of the individuals that God raised up through those denominations. But sadly, some of those churches also stand as a testimony to the fact that within a generation or two, the fires died. You know, the Methodist movement, say, I mentioned John Wesley, it's extremely interesting, you know. You ever heard of the primitive Methodists? Actually, this chapel was a primitive Methodist chapel built in the 1870s. This, and it was a primitive Methodist chapel. Primitive Methodism started around about 1820s, 1830s, something like that. And it started as a result of a couple of men who began to have camp meetings in fields. In other words, they were open-air preachers, right? And they had these full one-day or more camp meetings in the open air. And it went down like a lead balloon with the established Methodist church, and they got kicked out. And I, as I recall from learning this at Bible school, I think we were told there that one man said in the Methodist church, there is no history of open-air preaching in the Methodist church. And this is within 100 years of Wesley's life. And the Methodist movement started through open-air preaching. And the point was, you see, the primitive Methodists started as an attempt to kind of go back to what Methodism was in its early days, you see. Isn't it amazing how quickly things... Now, don't get me wrong, there's still some lovely Methodist churches truly preaching the gospel here and in America and elsewhere in the world. There really is. But equally so, there's a lot of dead ones too, sadly. You know, and I'm not no axe to grind against Methodists. You'll find the same in the various Baptist churches. There are some fantastic Baptist churches, sound solid on the word and everything. And you'll find others that are totally liberal. Gone like that. How quickly it can go. And so, in closing, I just want to point out a couple of things that came out in my own personal Bible reading this morning. And I was just in the first three chapters of Revelation, and so this was out of chapter two of Revelation. Sorry, I was in chapter two of Revelation, and of course here you've got the Lord's message to various churches. So the first is to the angel of the church at Ephesus, right? So the Lord says various things to the church of Ephesus. And by and large, he's pleased with this church. He's pleased with the heart, with their attitude, with the work, and all the rest of it, and the diligence. And then he says, "Nevertheless, I have this against you. You have left your first love. Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen, repent and do the first works." So, in other words, I mean, that's really the only negative thing the Lord's got to say to me. He's saying, look, you know, you need to realise you've lost your first love. Repent, go back and do the first things. So then you go to the next one, persecuted church. The Lord actually has nothing bad to say about them. But then you come to the compromising church, the church at Pergamos. And then in verse 14 he says, "I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate." So his criticism of this church is that they allow certain people to remain amongst them who are already being and will increasingly be an extremely detrimental influence on the life of the church. And his criticism is, you let them stay. Mm. Is there nothing about it? That's his criticism of them. Then you go to the next one, the church at Thyatira, and it says in verse 20, nevertheless, I have a few things against you, because you allow that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality and eat things offered to idols. So these have gone a step further. They don't just allow the false teachers to remain, they're now allowing them to teach. And as I was reading this one, I saw, here you can see a development. It starts with a loss of first love. It graduates to allowing things to remain within the church that ought to be challenged. And then eventually, it starts to let the false teachers say whatever they want. And I would imagine that every dead church followed a similar process. Started in the fires of revival, after a while began to lose the first love, started to allow things to remain unchecked within the church, say nothing, let's just all get on. And then eventually the liberals and the false teachers rise from the ranks, and they are then allowed to teach and then seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality, which means spiritual adultery and so on. And that's how the disaster happens within a short space of time. John is writing Revelation in the 90s AD, and the Lord was resurrected in the 30s. Mm. Well, we're talking about verse 60 on years. It's a generation. And that's how quickly it can happen. So the point being, and maybe it's a useful thing to realise at the start of a new year. We've got to be watchful. We've got to maintain the good thing that the Lord has given to us, and ensure that we keep those things the Lord has given to us, right, and maintain our first love, and all the more as we see the day approaching. Because just like the people in the days of Nimrod, we've still got people around us who know the truth and who speak the truth and can be consulted. We don't have to be driven along with the world, do we? So next week, God willing, we're going to think about Nimrod and